The advertisement for Holiday Inn, you're all familiar with it, where the character comes to the motel, not the Holiday Inn, and something is terribly wrong, and the desk clerk rings the little bell and says, "Surprise!" And then the Holiday Inn comes on with, "The best surprise is no surprise." Robert Frost, in talking about writing about poetry, has a kind of different view of surprise. And he says, "No surprise for the poet, no surprise for the reader." I want to start tonight with a poem that surprised me. It's called The Task of Adam. It's the title poem of the volume. And when I began to write it, I didn't know what I was writing about. And when I was finished, I wasn't sure I knew what I was writing about, but I liked it. Since this is 1984, I'd like to call this my Orwell poem. It's about language, I think. It's about politics, I think. And on the other hand, it may be just the plain old love poem. So we'll see how they fit together. I was reading Emerson at the time. You put all of this together and you can get a strange brew. So lines from Emerson that leads the poem. He says, "Bare list of words are found suggestive to an imaginative and excited mind." Well, one morning early, I was in an imaginative and excited mood, and I came into my office, and this is what happened. "Open by chance to page 1376, and left on the desk outside my office door, the American Heritage Dictionary arrest my attention. The photograph in the margin is what does it. Nestled neatly between a drawing of Salmo truta, the brown trout, fat substitute for the classy rainbow, introduced to New York waters by eager sportsmen at Caledonia, and outline sketches of six different trowels, the mustached face of Trotsky glares up at my complacency. I read, Russian revolutionist and Soviet statesman banished 1929, assassinated in Mexico. That is all I know of revolution and all I need to know. The trout and the trowel, the stream and the garden mark the limits of my care. The task of Adam cast into the bramble, no more is all I choose." Ah, Emerson. "The corruption of man is followed by the corruption of language. These old words are perverted. Take, for example, the guide words in the corner of this page, troposphere and truckle. They enclose the revolution as surely as trout and trowel. Troubadour, trousers, trousseau, all between them. The succession from poetry to pants to the bridal bed is achieved as readily as my eye glides down the page. But the guide words fly off into abstraction, troposphere and truckle. Fasten them to the world, breath and bed. Let Trotsky glare. Revolution is redefining words. Adam among his brambles in alliance with truth and God is panting after Eve." Well, politics, language, love, I don't know. But we've got Adam tromping around the broccoli. So, a poem about the garden. A little different tone in this one. "The garden soil, a fertile bed I have made of waste, rises above the untutored grass. Though mine by deed, I cannot own the garden. It owns me. I give myself a tree growing in the ambience of my falling into earth. Well, any poem about a garden with the word fall into it certainly suggests things. So we should have a poem about a snake. Actually, I have two poems about a snake. Both true. One is more or less simple reportage. Parrot green, the summer snake curled on the fall-warm bed of the railroad. Kill it, cried Matt Scott, grabbing for stones. I stayed their arms. You like snakes? Scott asked. We need them, I answered. This kind eats spiders, snails, and slugs. Huh, scoffed Matt. How come, if they're so good, Satan's one? This one is a little different, a little more serious than the first snake poem. This is called Ritual. And I think it's about our inability to remove the snake from the garden on our own. The poem has a little place in it that's sometimes hard to follow when you're just listening. There are two snakes in this poem. The one in the present tense of the poem and one in a memory of something that occurred earlier. And so at the line, but a memory, it switches back to recount a separate incident and then comes forward again with that memory. So the stanza in between those lines is kind of a flashback in this. If that afternoon I'd found the nerve to step from the door, I might have merely nudged the thick black racer with my boot and sent him crawling for the field. Or if, in less benign a mood, crushed his head or severed it with a quick clean swipe of the garden hoe from the coiled whip of his body. But a memory. Once, when I was 5 or 6, I ran barefoot from the house and met the shock of flesh, my soul planted in the writhing tangle of a cold green snake basking in the sun. That memory kept me inside when mother, huddling in her need of enmity, said, "Do something." I looked long at the snake, his quiet coil, his tongue flicking, flicking, his lidless eyes. I'll shoot him, I said, and went to get my bow. 5 bright arrows splashed like light into the darkness of that flesh. 5 purple roses blossomed against the black. But no light found the grim liveliness between the eyes, or the heart hidden in the twisting pain that turned upon itself, and throwing coils about my bolts, thrust them from its body, and heaved itself into the field beside the house. At sunset, I searched and found, as I expected, nothing. As I said, my mother was involved in that poem and the snake, and unlike my brother, who kept snakes for pets, so that we grew up with snakes in the bedroom, my mother did not care for them. And when my father died one of the difficulties, one of the things that practically drove her from the house was the problem with the snakes, because unable to keep the fields mowed and having grain around and so on from when we had the horses, she had mice, and the mice brought snakes, and she would go out through the tack room towards the garage and find large black snakes coiled up on the floor and the rafters and the grain, so on. And she did not care for this too much. The snake doesn't get in this poem, but the weeds do. This is called Sacramental Vision. Sometimes in my dream, he is still alive. We stand at the fence talking about the garden. Plant kohlrabi, he says. And I remember the way he'd slice white wafers from the bulb, offering them to me balanced on his knife blade. I would eat again that sharp sacrament and join myself to that good world he walks. But I wake in time, and know my flesh is one with frailty. The garden I must tend is dark with weeping, grown up in widow's weeds. I had a very hard time in planning this reading, deciding exactly what I was going to start with. And as I was going through my poems earlier this week, I came across one that I really wanted to read, but I had no idea where it would fit into the reading, because it's a poem that is in many ways fairly private. It's a poem for Elliot Coleman, the man I studied with at Johns Hopkins, called The Mockingbird Variations. And I thought for a while I would open with it, but I've decided to place it here as a kind of transition. I've been looking at poems relating to the garden and the Adam image and the fall, and I'm going to move after this poem through some poems relating to that theme in a more personal way. But I want to read The Mockingbird Variations. But to do it, I need to read one poem of Elliot Coleman's to you called Winter Over Nothing. And then I want to read to you a short passage from the journal In Season and Out that will provide the context for The Mockingbird Variations. To understand this poem, imagine yourself an old man. You've had a full, distinguished career, and you have suffered several strokes. You're in an airplane flying over Greenland. Winter over nothing. The time of nobody and nothing has come. Vestiges, footprints of beauty and beauties fall in snowflakes and soon are nothing but unrecalled patterns. The living are nothing. The beloved are finally nothing. Oh, that something so full of something should turn out to be nothing, should turn inside out to be nothing. In the winter, nothing. Oh, that somebody so full of somebody should become nobody, nothing. That oneself should be no self, and the best thing be no thing. Winter, breathless, nothing. Snow us under, winter over nothing. This is the entry now from In Season or Out. The poet referred to at the beginning is not Elliot Coleman. He comes in later. Thursday I went to hear a poet I've much admired. I heard a broken old man who fumbled with his book, who spilled his water, who worked his lips chewing the air, who drooled, who finally forcing words from his mouth spoke in a thin, unsteady voice that could not make the sounds of his poems. Though listening to him was agony, I felt a bit of wonder. For I attributed his mannerisms to a stroke and saw a triumph in his standing before us. As he read from his newest book, I heard the voice of affirmation, the voice of the religious faith he'd rejected 15 years ago returning. And I thought, illness can do that for a man. And then I thought of Elliot Coleman, the wonderful, virtually unknown poet I studied with at Johns Hopkins. I visited him once in his old age. Broken by a stroke, the elegant Anglophile I knew had become a bearded, wild old man, a Whitman on the streets of Baltimore. At lunch, he rose on his cane and declaimed loud enough for the whole restaurant to hear, "I never wanted to be old. I never thought I'd be old. And now that I'm old, I don't like it." Later in the afternoon, in a quieter moment, he remembered serving communion in a military hospital during World War II. Tears filled his eyes and made a grim contrast to his gesture of dismissal. But that was my Anglican period. I don't believe anything now. The first thing to go, you know, was a belief in the afterlife. Once that was gone, he shrugged, nothing. I quoted one of his new poems. That was Winter Over Nothing that I read to you. I quoted one of his new poems and tried to talk of the dark night of the soul. He wouldn't hear of it. "If you want to think of it that way," he said, "okay, but it's not. It's nothing. And when the time comes, I know where the pills are." He didn't use the pill, but he died confessing nothing. What started this brooding on illness and loss is a celebration. Today is Houghton's centennial homecoming. One of my former students, who is studying at the university where the poet I heard Thursday teaches, told me he has never had a stroke. He is suffering the last stages of chronic alcoholism. The only thing driving him back to his faith is guilt and fear and grace. But what drove Elliot Coleman in his last days? Why, if God is faithful to complete the work he begins, did he allow Elliot to die in darkness and despair? Now, this poem is for Elliot. It's called The Mockingbird Variations. It has that title for two reasons. The most wonderful thing about Baltimore is the mockingbird. I remember the first time I heard the mockingbird in Baltimore, it was 2 a.m. when I woke Linda up and she killed me. Then she heard the mockingbird and forgave me. I used to lay awake night listening to them. And I suspect that Elliot Coleman did, for one of his books is called Mockingbirds at Fort McHenry, and almost every other one of his books has a mockingbird in it somewhere. The Mockingbird Variations for Elliot Coleman. 10 years ago in Baltimore, a mockingbird wakened me. I lay listening halfway between sleep and day, As he turned variations of such clarity, the world assumed the stillness of his center. When I turned north, the memory of his song bore me home. I am south again, and this morning, walking along a berry-lined road in Louisville, I caught the familiar soft gray flutter and flash of white against the rust and red of November bushes. Like a fold in the earth's crust, time lay over on itself. The mockingbird, however, did not sing. I thought of you in Stella Maris. What light becomes the virgin song, I cannot say. But the mockingbird variations played against Baltimore mornings remain and will remain. Got three poems now that all work in somewhat the same manner. The poems are called Questions and Answers, The South Debate, and my favorite all-time title, The Glory, The Tired Evangelist, and The Light of the Moon. Now, these three poems get everything in them. The way they work is they begin in the present, and something happens, something leads me back in a memory, and then they return to the present. Questions and Answers and The South Debate both return me to my freshman year in college, which was not spent at Houghton. And you will see. A few weeks ago in Writer's Workshop, I had a guest in reading a poem, and she read a poem about getting beer from the refrigerator when she wanted wine. And somebody in the class asked the question, can poems about beer be written at Houghton? I'll let the second poem in this series answer that question. I wrote it at Houghton. Okay. Questions and Answers. What was I after that fall in the hardtop board, beating time on the dash, digging Ray Charles blues, hurtling 90 miles an hour into the Ohio night? Certainly not Bobby, live country girl, hair whipping in the wind, 5 years my elder, meaning unattainable and therefore oh so desirable behind the wheel. But if not Bobby, what? Oh, more than the wind and the music, more than the rush of vanity that I was chosen to make that ride into darkness, more even than the darkness itself struck brilliant by stars and moon. Yet why did I go? Knowing, as even then I must have known, that nothing, nothing could come of such wantonness. The ride ended as it began, drawn up to the curb, lost in the lyrics beamed across the hog belt from Cincinnati. Hit the road, Jack, and don't you come back no more, no more, no more, no more. Hit the road, Jack. What drives me back? What makes me defy Ray Charles and return guilt-ridden to that autumn of my youth? Tonight, in the darkness, driving home, an old song on the radio, the wind in my face, and the pungent sting of the pig farm across the valley. Friend, I've lied. The girl at the wheel was not Bobby. Bobby was a crippled drama major we sent hunching to the room before our flight. The girl at the wheel, I've forgotten her name. I was 18. What does it matter? Only this. At twice 18, an exquisite pain, a memory, these words, and the knowledge I know myself no better now than then. Linda can tell you her name when you're having coffee afterwards. Something about it, I blotted it out. This was a great college I was at. I really liked the place. I don't know why I ever left. It's probably a good thing I did. The South debate. It's self-explanatory. Everything in it happens exactly as it's told. This is testimony. Again, beginning in the present and moving back and forth. Humid late summer night slashed by silent lightning, but the air cooling, caressing the chest stripped bare against the indoor heat, and the mind, indolent, loosed in the stirring of leaves across the yard, floats backward to an Ohio Friday night the year you entered college. The fight is on in the gobbler's lounge. Who's winning, you ask? Beats me, a card player answers, but that guy in white's about to get killed. You watch, and minutes later, Benny Ken Kid Perez takes it on the chin and drops forever dead to the canvas. In the sudden hush, awed in the act of discarding, the casual prophet swears. More than restless, you suck Kentucky Kings all the way to the neon welcome of hammies and the flowing promise of black label signs in the windows. Inside, the comforting dark and jukebox funny Valentine breaks your heart so beautifully you can't imagine any other life. You drink a beer or two with friends, punish your stomach with hammies chili, and join the South debate. Proposed. Life has meaning. Pro and con. You want to assume the existence of God and go from there, but no one will let you. Damn, you are lonely. So lonely, if the girl beside you in the booth would. But virtue's closest friend is fear. You know you wouldn't. The irony rocks you back to the present. In the house, your daughter plays the old records you could not throw away. The recurrence is too much. Nearly you cry out loud, as nearly you cried that night, not, oh, who am I, but who would care if I knew? Only now, free in the life you have made, you turn to the light about the music, make assumptions, and go from there. Now, for the tired evangelist, the glory, and so on. This is a strange experience. I've tried to write about it a number of times. I've published other poets on it, and I kind of promised myself that this is the last one, and it has to be if this poem is true. Anyway. Once, years ago, the clouds split. Light rained and soaked me dumb. I fled the Laurel Mountainside and sought to name the brightness, but I learned no name for glory. The word I woke on the tongue of a tired evangelist called to tame youth's unruly stirring, spoke to itself. Thank God, brother, it cried, flinging its holy, benevolent arm across my back. Thank God, for he has spoken and taken you for his own. Almost I embrace the ecstasy of grace unreasonable. But knowledge leapt unknown from the rattle in his throat. The sky was empty. The glory was a choir blared suddenly across the valley over the same PA that shocked our senses awake each morning of that summer camp. The name of what I'd seen was nothing. Yet all these years, I've held close that instant of light descending, of glory apprehended, then drowned in waking human voices. No more. I've turned that memory loose. Last night, I stood in the chill of winter. Sheer, pellucid clouds blew like curtains in front of the moon. No voices sounded from behind the veil, nor did I long for them. But somewhere in the depths of nothing, the flameless incandescent burned, and the soft white of light reflected lay like silence on the night. Wanting good intentions too, and somehow or other they got mixed up, and I don't know who published what anymore, but I had good intentions of keeping them straight. Bob Siegel said this is my Zen Buddhist poem. 24 hours after jerking the chainsaw into life, my ears ring from its all-day snarl. Oh, not for the last time have I set those teeth in a log, but for the last time have I found pleasure in their noisy bite. Too loud they are, and hungry for wood and flesh. I will learn the ways of saws that talk in oak as soft as wind in leaves. Husha, husha, husha. Don't believe it. I've got a big cross-cut saw, and I've used it. When we first got to Houghton, we lived in the faculty apartments way up on top of the hill, and we had a bird feeder out in the back. We still have a bird feeder, but anyway. The next poem is called At the Winter Feeder, and it is a description of something I watched time after time one winter. It really happened. It's not something one would have the nerve to make up. His feather flame doused dull by ice and cold, the cardinal hunched into the rough green feeder, but ate no seed. Through binoculars I saw, festered and useless, his beak broken at the root. Then two, one blazing, one gray, rode the swirling weather into my vision and lighted at his side. Unhurried, as if possessing the patience of God, they cracked sunflowers and fed him, beak to wounded beak, choice meats. Each morning and afternoon, the winter long, that odd triumvirate, that trinity of need, returned and ate their sacrament of broken seed. According to the weather report, I hear we're supposed to have 3 days of thawing. That's nice. But it will freeze at night. And when you start to get the freeze and thaw, you start to get maple weather. Four clear nights, the wood smoke rising blue against the quarter moon black, the house cracking in the below zero plunge into dark, say, winter holds. The earth, however, dumb and slow, turns, leans into light, and day lengthens. The ground, caught in the altercation of freeze and thaw, heaves, and in the maples, the run of sweetness augurs the water baptism, the scouring melt, and the planted seed. Two more poems about light and vision. This one is called The Strike. Unschooled in the art of reading water, of saying by its flow where trout wait, I laid my rod aside, lingered on the bank, and drifted in my winter books. Is it the brown who thrives within the rushing tumble of the ripples, and the rainbow who lolls in the quiet eddies, or the other way around? Resigned to take what rose, I cast across the current. It arced my line downstream and dragged the gray nymph through itself so swiftly even I was spooked. I should have gone home for a guide. I needed to know more than I knew. But the declivities of nature and will drew me on until the stream emptied into a narrow lake. As I descended, the light, knife sharp and shining, changed, grew cold, and shone as through a sheet of ice. A nimbus ringed each tree that speared leafless from the hills looming at the water's edge. On the flat of mud, I stood beside the heron's four-pronged spore and looked on his absence. Emptiness filled the gorge. I cast into the wind cutting down the valley. My line shot out and laid the nymph without a ripple on the surface. I waited till it sank and twitched it back. A sudden weight, like sleep, livened my fingers. It swerved in the water, then was gone. What struck, I do not know. Now, days later, caught by what I cannot catch, I return. I bring my presence to the stream, and laboring in the wind, wait for grace to strike and hold. Have you ever noticed when the geese fly south in the fall, you don't go out of the house to watch them? But when they come back in the spring, you drop everything and run outside. Then you remember you're in your bare feet. This is about the geese returning. Night vision. Often the geese fly at night. I watch them, dark against dark sky, beat northward. Tonight, when I heard their wild calling, one darkness filled my eyes. I saw nothing I could see. Joyous in the music of their flight, I cried to all I saw, thanks be for vision, vision, vision. We have at the back some little pamphlets called The Bone Dove. I'm going to close with a few poems from that. I've been concerned this semester in teaching the writing of poetry class that the students begin to develop a sense of form in a poem. And so I have given them an assignment to write a sequence, a kind of poetic diary in a Japanese form. And not liking to ask my students to do things I have never done, I started to work on this kind of sequence myself. And here are a few poems from it. The sequence is going to be called The Thawing Light. And what I'm doing is consciously working with images of light and the movement of it. And I began the sequence just before Christmas, and I intend to end the sequence at Easter. So it's for a set period, and you can see how it's going to work thematically, because that's also going to deal with the returning light of the earth and the spring and all of those kinds of things. If you're going to do a sequence, it pays to plan it out ahead so you have some idea of what you're looking for. Now, the Japanese form is loaded with puns. So things should go as many ways as possible in these poems. For example, in the first one, which I'm not going to read, the last line is, two lines, is, "I write them in a book given to proclaim Christ's birth." Well, I intend two things. I'm literally copying the poems down in a little book that was given to me for Christmas. So the book was given for that, but also it has to do with the purpose of choosing this particular sequence, starting with the birth and moving through and so on. So they're loaded with little meanings like that. The form here, and I hope I have counted correctly in doing all these, it's a syllabic form, and it is supposed to be 577577. The Sidoka, if that's how you say it, is also translated head poem. I don't know what that means. But it's an archaic form that the Japanese decided was too long. And ideally, you should write in a tanka, which is one line shorter. But for the life of me, I'm too wordy. And I just couldn't get anything said in the shorter form. So having started, resorted to the longer one, I'm sticking with it. I want to read the third one, the title one, The Bone Dove. I published a little sequence of poems in The Other Side last year, and at the end of the year, the editor sent all the contributors a gift. And what he sent was a tiny bone dove that was hand-carved in Peru. And so I made a necklace of it and gave it to Linda. So this is it. The bone dove, a poor Peruvian's hand-carved work, sent to me for poems made in trust, I've given to my wife. When she wears it, the kingdom of Christ is near. Over Christmas, it was at New Year's, I guess, I was away at Christmas, I went to the communion service in the village church, and the next is about that. Lest anyone here think I'm accusing him or her of being a dying saint, I don't mean that at all. We are, however, all dying slowly with a little patience. I was thinking as I wrote this poem about fellowship, I guess, or maybe something more profound than that word seems to carry with it. The faith of dying saints, holy ones kneeling to receive the host, is a stream of living water. Their fierce rush lifts me to Christ. Incarnate grace floods the earth. The next one is one that is filled with puns, probably particularly appropriate in the light of today's chapel. Jesus is the light hidden under the bushel of commerce. Who buys and sells the good of planet earth squanders hope. Let light shine, trade freely, keep no accounts. Two more. Abandoned poems. Hands worn hard by labor give better tongue to truth than words. Come, work beside me. Turn the garden earth to light. Let our hope be found in fact. We're back in the garden. That's where we started. And I want to read one last one that I didn't have written when I typed those. Remember I said this thing, these things are loaded with puns. There are six words in the last line of this one. Four of them are puns. Through the zero night, you sleep undisturbed by nails booming loose. I lie awake. Cold hands grip my throat. If I should die before you wake, be still in morning light.